Today at Reader's Corner, John C. McManus, author of The Dead and Those About to Die, D-Day, the big red one at Omaha Beach.
Omaha Beach is where the bloodiest and most difficult fighting happens on D-Day. It's sort of the nexus of this larger Allied beachhead. Omaha Beach for the Big Red One is like the classic example of Murphy's Law. I mean, pretty much everything goes wrong. The tides are off. Some of the assault troops come in about a half an hour late, which allows the Germans to focus on specific targets and devastate them one by one. Colonel George Taylor, commander of the lead assault unit for the Big Red One, he is responsible for the phrase, only two kinds of people going to be on this beach, the dead and those who are going to die.
I'm Bob Custra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. This weekend marks the 71st anniversary of D-Day, the invasion on June 6, 1944, on the beaches of Normandy that turned the tide of fighting in World War II Europe and led to an Allied victory. Military historian John C. McManus offers an insider's look at just one of the five beaches taken by Allied troops in his book, The Dead and Those About to Die, D-Day, the Big Red One at Omaha Beach. The book, which is out this weekend in paperback, centers largely on the exploits of the 1st Infantry Division and includes detailed personal accounts of some of the soldiers who were part of World War II's longest day. Today we're featuring an encore edition of our interview with Dr. McManus. He is a professor of U.S. military history at the Missouri University of Science and Technology and the author of 11 books. Dr. McManus joins us by phone for this interview. John C. McManus, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thank you, Bob. It's a real pleasure to be here.
Well, John, I was, strangely enough, watching a TV show the other day. I literally passed the TV and my wife was watching Nova, and it was a story of D-Day. And they had Eisenhower quoted as saying, 500 years from now, people will never remember I was president of the United States. They will remember that I led the Allied invasion at Normandy. And I suppose that sums up where this battle, where the D-Day invasion stands in American history and in American military history in particular.
Yeah, that's so true. It is a legendary moment in American history and military history. And of course, Eisenhower having command of it, I think it's fair to say that's the most famous command in the history of the United States Armed Forces. And obviously it launched him to great political heights. But D-Day, the invasion, whatever you would like to call it, or Omaha Beach itself, which is the part of it that my new book focuses on, I would argue really is right up there in terms of legendary battles with battles like Gettysburg or Antietam in American history.
One of the things that struck me about your book's description of the events leading up to the actual invasion was just how much discretion the generals who planned this invasion had. And it got me to thinking about whether or not in our recent incursions, whether it's Afghanistan or Iraq, do our generals have that same amount of discretion? Is there more White House or presidential sign-off of how a battle is going to be conducted? Is there any way you can compare or contrast the extent of discretion? It just seems like these generals planning the invasion had enormous discretion. And frankly, obviously, your book doesn't deal with it, but I'm sure there's plenty of other accounts of the role that presidents play.
Yeah, of course, every year is different. World War II, I see as a kind of a, I won't call it a rare moment, but I would say an exceptional moment of relatively harmonious civil-military relations in which, really when we think of it, we all favor civil control over the military. The question is how involved the civilian elected leaders ought to be. And I tend to think they ought to be involved in whatever has impact on the overall strategic objectives of whatever the purpose of these military operations might be. Well, in World War II, FDR has tremendous power in, deciding and shaping grand strategy, deciding where American soldiers are going to fight, apportioning resources and all that. But once those decisions are made, he tends to let the generals handle most of the details and most of the leading on the ground. The overall strategic purpose has been decided. Are we going to fight in World War II against Germany and Japan or not? Okay, how are we going to beat them and where? And then the generals handle the rest of it. So when you're talking about the Normandy invasion, it really is Eisenhower's call as to how this is going to be done. Now, having said that, I should also point out that Churchill happens to be right there. And so Churchill's constantly in Eisenhower's ear with suggestions as only he could do. So that was a big part of Eisenhower's job, is to take care of the political flank, in Britain, but also, by extension, in the United States as well. But I tend to see World War II as the exception rather than the rule, as far as civilian leaders being heavily involved in military operations.
So Omaha Beach, the focus of your book, is one of just five beaches involved in the D-Day assault. Why Omaha Beach above the others?
Omaha Beach is where the bloodiest and most difficult fighting happens on D-Day. Not that there isn't heavy fighting elsewhere, but among the invasion beaches, Omaha Beach really is the costliest, and that is the one that the Germans come closest to victory. And Omaha Beach is, I think, almost any Allied invasion planner would tell you in that time, really the most important of all the beaches, because it's sort of the nexus. It's sort of the torso of this larger Allied beachhead. The British and Canadian beaches are to the east. The other American landing beach, Utah Beach, is to the west. You've got to have Omaha Beach in order to connect the two and have a unified beachhead and eventually move beyond Normandy. So Omaha Beach was bound to be probably the most difficult simply because of the terrain. You have a kind of a prominent ridgeline that broods over about a 4.5 to 5 mile crescent-shaped beach, thus ideal for defenders, high ground overlooking a narrow beach. All those kinds of things are going to be daunting. And it actually, if you think about it in the larger span of military operations in the European theater, it bore a remarkable, almost startling resemblance to the beach at Salerno in Italy, where the Allies had invaded in September of 43 and come very close to defeat there as well.
So the Germans had 4 years to prepare for this, and if you take a look at some of those bunkers, I visited Normandy and Omaha Beach 3 years ago, I guess it's been, and if you take a look at those bunkers, you can see that that was real serious construction. They had a lot of time to do it. So the Allies are looking for men that are going to get this job done, and they turn to the 1st Division, as it's called, the Big Red One. Help us understand their coming to that conclusion.
Yeah, the Big Red One among American senior leaders at that point in the war has a reputation as something of a go-to unit. The 1st Infantry Division, or Big Red One as it was their nickname, had fought in both North Africa and Sicily. They'd carried out two amphibious invasions. They had spent a lot of time on the front lines, and they had a reputation as a unit that got results, that attained objectives, that could be relied upon, a kind of a fighting unit that was very good in combat. Now, when they were off the line was another matter. The Big Red One had a reputation of being tempestuous, rebellious, troublemaking, trouble-seeking, carousing and drinking and partying and you name it, and, just general kind of undisciplined. So
one may go with the other, actually, but anyway.
Yeah, it really would. That's correct. You see that tendency, and there's a natural resentment you're going to have between those who do most of the fighting, the combat soldiers, and the large numbers of support troops that are required to keep them in action. The combat soldiers naturally resent that, and when they're off the line, they want privileges, which they don't always get. So by the spring of 44, the Big Red One is seen by General Omar Bradley, who's to be the ranking American ground commander, as absolutely imperative and crucial to the invasion. But, of course, there's great resentment among some of the surviving veterans of the Big Red One at that point, being chosen to lead yet another invasion when they felt that they ought to be rotated home. So the unit is a mixture of these hard-bitten, rather cynical and jaded, but quite savvy veterans of the Mediterranean, with the new guys who have replenished the ranks, who are trying to live up to the esprit de corps. Really, really quite a fascinating mixture of personalities.
And then along the way, there's a change in leadership from General Terry Allen, who was revered by those troops, to this new guy, Clarence Huebner. Tell us what Huebner does to motivate these guys and get them ready for this battle.
Yeah, this gives us even more interesting insight into the unit's personality. Terry Allen, as you mentioned, was indeed beloved by the soldiers of the Big Red One. He was an earthy cavalryman who was a great combat leader and was the kind of person that, as an ordinary soldier, you probably would have seen and met and had a good experience with at some point. He and Ted Roosevelt, his second-in-command, who was, of course, the son of the president, had a remarkably similar leadership styles, but they're held accountable by Bradley and also General Patton for what was perceived as the undisciplined nature of the 1st Division. So they are, in essence, fired from their command, and Clarence Huebner takes over with more of a severe disciplinarian kind of streak in him. And many of the soldiers, not really knowing anything about his background, unfairly branded him as this kind of stateside guy who cared about just, you know, nitpicking discipline at the expense of real combat preparation and all that. Well, that wasn't fair at all, because Huebner had carved out an amazing combat record of leadership in World War One, and he had done it in the Big Red One. He had earned a commission. He had served in every rank from lieutenant to lieutenant colonel. He was badly wounded. He had gotten the Distinguished Service Cross. You could argue he has the most distinguished record of any American combat leader in that war, and he had logged a lot of time with the division. But you know, these young guys in 44 don't know that. So when he comes aboard, he kind of changes the culture, though he really respected Allen deeply and never undercut him. He changes the culture to, I think you could say, deal with a bit more of the details of how to clean your weapons, how to keep them tended to, how to make sure your marksmanship was where it needed to be, weapons proficiency of all the different weapons you were going to have to yield and know, physical fitness, all those kinds of things that probably needed to be shaped up a bit before a major invasion like Omaha Beach.
You're listening to John C. McManus. He's the author of The Dead and Those About to Die. How much time did he have to do that from the time he picks these guys up in North Africa and moves them to the south of Britain where they're going to go into training? What's the time factor there?
From the perspective of a lot of other commanders who didn't have this sort of time, he has the luxury of about 8-9 months. He takes over at the end of the Sicily campaign in August 1943, and in the next month, the unit is rotated to England after Sicily is over with. So he's got about 8-9 months. To get the division ready. And even then, of course, it's very difficult. But one of the things that earns him some respect over time, although initially he's kind of hated for the strict discipline and all this, what earns him respect is his personal competence and proficiency with weapons, which is remarkable. He's a guy in his mid-50s who can shoot better than than most of his 19- and 20-year-old riflemen. He goes through the obstacle courses alongside everybody else. He just is a professional. He knows his business. And when he does kind of dress you down, he never humiliates you. He's always teaching. He had a nickname, the coach. And so I believe he trains this division to a kind of a winning standard. And I think that's one of the things that's going to make a difference on D-Day.
And I think you talked about the boat teams that he organized. Does that refer specifically to the Higgins boats that would eventually be used to land?
That's right. In each one of those boats, you generally have about 32 soldiers and their weapons. And, you know, those are the assault troops who are going to lead the way at Omaha Beach. And the unit is trained so repeatedly and to such a high standard, and so many mock invasions, that a lot of these guys swear they're part of the Navy rather than the Army. Each guy, where he is on the boat, is planned. It's not an accident. It's not random at all. So depending on what weapon you had, what your job was, it impacted where you were going to stand and what you were supposed to do once the ramp went down. And I believe that they had a very appropriate kind of division of leadership on these boats, where the officer in charge of the boat would be at the front and would basically lead the way and assume many of the dangers, of course, but lead the way and inspire and do the thinking and the managing. In the rear of the boat is his ranking NCO, who will operate as a kind of a push man, say, hey, to everybody, don't get reluctant, we're all getting off this boat, and I'm going to make sure of it. So they knew exactly what they were supposed to do once they hit the shores of Omaha Beach.
But what they didn't know is how things would go wrong, weather among other things, but help us understand the complications that ensued.
Omaha Beach for the Big Red One is the classic example of Murphy's Law. I mean, pretty much everything goes wrong. They had this minute plan in which the pre-invasion bombardment by air and sea was really supposed to neutralize most of the really rather powerful German defenses there and bunkers. Well, it barely scratches it. The bombing happened way too far inland, has really no effect. The naval bombardment lasts 45 minutes, nowhere near long enough. I calculated that in the 1st Division sector, This bombardment slightly wounded two German soldiers and knocked out a couple of automatic flamethrowers. It wasn't pleasant for the Germans, but it did next to nothing. The plan was predicated on the idea of having a combined arms force land at the same moment. So engineers, tanks, and then the assault infantry were all supposed to touch down at the same moment, presenting the Germans with too many targets to even deal with. And then the tanks would saturate the surviving Germans with fire. The engineers would blow gaps through the obstacles and the mines, which were extensive. And then the infantry could maneuver and basically get inland quite hurriedly. Well, as I mentioned, the tides are off. You've got smoke and sea spray and fog and cloudy overcast. You have some of the assault troops come in about a half an hour late in haphazard, piecemeal, which allows the Germans to focus on specific targets and to just devastate them one by one.
And their equipment was a problem as well. Tell us about how they were burdened by all this equipment and how heavy it really was.
These guys are carrying way too much stuff. The average soldier, about 70, 80 pounds of equipment and gear, and most of them are on their boats for about 2 hours or so before they hit the beach, at least. And that's very uncomfortable. Maintaining your footing, you're probably very wet by that point. A lot of them are seasick, and then they're burdened down with all of this stuff. So some of them are in heavy water. They're incredibly uncomfortable. They're frightened out of their wits. And this is a time when they need to move rapidly and maneuver quickly because you've got such heavy enemy fire.
And you throw in severe seasickness and you're doomed.
Yeah, most definitely. And a lot of these guys, they're so seasick when they get off their boats, they can hardly even care what happens next. One of them, one little anecdote, a guy named PFC John McPhee, who like a lot of these guys, was very young and superb physical condition. He's, I think, 19, 20 years old. Could march for days, with a heavy pack and still fight and whatever. Well, by the time he gets ashore on D-Day morning, he's so weighed down and so seasick that, as he put it, I couldn't care less if Adolf Hitler himself were waiting for me.
Well, the beaches, if they made it to the beaches were rigged with several types of lethal landmines, and obviously efforts to clear them didn't exactly pan out. Help us understand why that is the case.
Right. Earlier we were talking about how the Germans had 4 years to fortify the coast. Well, it's really in about the 5-6 months that precede D-Day that the Germans begin to build the most formidable of all the fortifications there, and many of the ones that the Big Red One is going to assault. And one of the things they've done that really strengthens it is just sow the place liberally with obstacles that are designed to tear up landing craft, to hold up soldiers, to pin them on the beach, because that's what the Germans have to do, pin them on the beach and slaughter them there. And this is the concept of Field Marshal Erwin Rommel, who believes that the invasion has to be defended at the coast, that everything will be decided there. And so this is a rather disquieting development to the Allied planners. From about March onward is just how heavily mined and obstacled Omaha Beach is going to be. So about one out of every four of the soldiers who comes ashore at Omaha Beach is an engineer, specifically to deal with these obstacles. Well, one such group were what were called gap assault teams of Army and Navy engineers. And the Navy was supposed to deal with everything that was under the water, and the Army everything else. Well, the gap assault teams are landing right at H hour, and they are extraordinarily vulnerable. They take 45% casualties and upward. They have a hard time dealing with the obstacles, blowing gaps in them. You've got the chaos of so many other soldiers around, the bitter German opposition. Gap assault teams are vulnerable because they're carrying a lot of explosives. So when you get a hit as a German machine gunner, say, or a mortarman, on a gap assault squad, you're likely to get a lot of sympathetic detonations because of all the explosives they're carrying. So you can imagine how grisly and gruesome that would be. And in many instances, when these guys do succeed in setting their charges and wiring up obstacles to blow gaps, they can't really blow their charges because other American soldiers are taking cover behind the obstacles and they can't get them to move.
Today we're talking with John C. McManus, the author of The Dead and Those About to Die, D-Day, the Big Red One at Omaha Beach. So the troops get past the mines, those that do get past the mines. What are they looking at? Help us visualize the landscape and what's their next assignment to get to those bunkers, I guess.
Yeah, you know, the bunkers tend to be on some of the higher ground for obvious reasons. And the main thing the Germans want to defend at Omaha Beach are the exits. Omaha Beach is really underdeveloped in terms of infrastructure. There's only one paved coastal road, and that's in the 29th Division sector to the west. Big Red 1 sector, there are no paved roads. The engineers are going to have to build them eventually. So if you're a soldier and you're coming in on that beach, you're probably looking at, off of your landing craft, about 300 to 400 yards of open ground with a lot of the heavy obstacles, hedgehogs and oversized Belgian gates. And if you can get beyond that mess, you've got what's called a shingle bank. It's kind of a bank of raised stones, smooth, rounded stones that are very slippery and difficult to negotiate, that really multiply the fragmentation effect of German artillery shells, which is the greatest danger in Omaha Beach, enemy artillery, and also mortar shells. If you can get beyond that, you're looking at a kind of usually an embankment and then ground that slopes upward, marshy ground, almost swamp-like. There's an anti-tank ditch, too, which is designed to impede vehicles, of course. And then you've got, if you can imagine, just kind of a general raising of the topography with dips and swales and little valleys and crevices. It's grassy, but it's very difficult to see and to have much visibility. But all of it leading upward several hundred feet to a rather prominent ridge line that kind of plateaus beyond that. So, and then on the eastern side, all of this is basically flanked by cliffs. So you have really impenetrable cliffs that lead to an embankment that's higher than a man is tall, and then eventually all this high ground. So it's really uninviting.
Were they necessarily trying to get past the bunkers and on into France, or did they have to? Were they assigned to taking out the bunkers first and then getting on to France?
They're assigned to take out those bunkers, but ideally they would do it from the side or behind, where, you know, along their what military people think of as their flanks, that would be vulnerable. The landing craft are supposed to hit the beach in what are really the dead spots in the German defenses. I mean, though Omaha Beach is formidable, the Germans couldn't defend everything, and they really didn't have all that many soldiers there. There were about 500 or so in the 1st Division sector. So most of the landing craft are supposed to hit in what's called Easy Red Beach, and that's kind of between two of the draws, and it's not as heavily defended. It's basically a lot of mines as you work your way up that high ground, and then some machine gun posts here and there. So that's really where you're supposed to go, work around those fixed positions, the bunkers we famously remember, and kind of hit them from behind or the side. And what goes wrong, as I mentioned, is just, you know, the timetable's blown, people land in the wrong spot, and they land in the kill zones for a lot of those prepared fortifications, and they're right at the waterline, wide open, nowhere really to hide. What starts to turn the battle around is when you see groups of Americans begin to make it off the beach, usually in those dead spots, and negotiating their way through or around mines, and kind of hitting the Germans from the sides and overwhelming those machine gun posts and just causing problems, what I've often called a knife in the vitals. There are several distinct groups in the course of the morning that do that, that begin to turn the battle around.
Speaking of getting off the beach, I must mention Colonel Taylor, because he, of course, is the reason why the title of your book is as it is. Please explain.
Colonel George Taylor was the commander of the 16th Infantry Regiment, which is the lead assault unit for the Big Red One at Omaha Beach, and kind of the go-to unit within the division, or certainly they thought of themselves as such. Taylor was really one of the leading minds among American amphibious invasion planners and thinkers. He'd had a lot of experience with this. He was a combat leader of the First Order. He was a 45-year-old West Pointer. And he, of course, is responsible for the phrase that I think is the most famous one associated with Omaha Beach, and it is this. There's only two kinds of people going to be on this beach, the dead and those who are going to die. Now, this is falsely attributed to someone else in the famous movie The Longest Day, Robert Mitchum's character, General Dutch Cota, second in command of the 29th Division, is portrayed saying that. Well, of course, he didn't say that. Taylor said that. And one of the things I found out in my research is that this was not a spontaneous phrase for Taylor. He'd been thinking of it for months. He wrote it in a memo about 8 months before D-Day. And his entire plan was predicated on this, that you just don't want to be on the beach, that the whole thing hinges on getting off the beach, and that's when you're going to make good things happen. So when he comes ashore about 2 hours after H hour, and the situation is still really crisis-ridden and chaotic, he strides up and down that beach and just constantly, almost obsessively saying this to people, and it is successful. I mean, it does two things. It saves a lot of lives. Because if you were an American on Omaha Beach on D-Day, then you were generally a target. If you got off the beach, you tended to be a hunter. And so he's able to just give people during a time of crisis something to fixate on, something to do, and to motivate them to get out of danger. Secondly, when he does this, it leads to crucial reinforcement for some of those first groups that had gotten off the beach that I had mentioned a few moments ago and were fighting inland and could have been vulnerable to German counterattacks. Now, when you've got more and more troops getting off the beach wherever they can find gaps or ways to do so, once that happens, it leads to kind of an overwhelming nature to the American assault on Omaha Beach that the Germans simply can't stand up to. They don't have enough people, and they don't have enough reinforcements in the area to turn the tide back in the other direction. So Taylor's actions were really quite crucial. He was earned the Distinguished Service Cross. He was promoted to one-star general. He was highly respected within his regiment and the division.
Well, John, I have time for one more question, and I'm going to ask you to kind of sum this up for us as far as how many troops were involved in the invasion, what were the casualties, how many landed at Omaha Beach in particular.
Right. At Omaha Beach, Bradley wants to put about 30,000 troops ashore. And by the end of the day, he's at least in the neighborhood. You have the better part of two divisions that have gotten ashore, the 1st and the 29th. And the beachhead is secured, though it's not really a front line so much as it's a series of perimeters, and both sides kind of bumping into each other in the course of the night. The casualty rates, well, historians are still debating of that today. I'll tell you what I found out. Just looking at the 1st Division records, 1st Division suffered at least 1,300 casualties in the course of D-Day, including over 300 fatalities. That's probably a lowball estimate that I use to conservatively estimate, but there were at least 500 more casualties from attached units. The casualty rates among the assault units tended to span anywhere from about 15 to 60 to 70%, something like that. So the cost was high, but I do think it could have been worse, believe it or not. The worst of D-Day is over by midday, and Omaha Beach, of course, is the costliest of all the beachheads. So the invasion as a whole is rather successful, and you're talking about over 140,000 troops who have been successfully landed by the end of the evening on D-Day.
Well, John, this has just been a great interview, and I didn't have a chance to get to the incredible tales of individual courage and bravery you tell in this book, and that's certainly some of the most inspiring parts of your book. I just urge our readers to get out and get a copy of this, and they can enjoy it and reflect on it as we did. In the meantime, thanks for helping us remember what we must never forget, and that is the sacrifices made at Normandy and throughout World War II that led to the Allied victories. I really appreciate your joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Thanks so much, Bob. It's all about the human story.
And that's right.
What animates my work, and that's what I hope people will take from this as well.
I hope you've enjoyed this encore edition of our interview with John C. McManus. Next week, we look into the future with James Barrett, author of Our Final Invention, Artificial Intelligence and the End of the Human Era. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, research by Kathleen Tuck. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner. Previous shows are online at BoiseStatePublicRadio.org or download our free player from the iTunes App Store to listen anytime.